Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. And today we're going to talk to someone rather special, a sort of person that we've never spoken to before. They come up with the title of Master Inventor. You might think, my goodness, what this is about? Potions? Is this something from Harry Potter? No. It's an engineer, a distinguished engineer from IBM. Her name is Romelia Flores, and she is one of these people that's become very distinguished within IBM, which is one of the biggest distinguished companies in computers and smart cities and smart everything. And Romelia, welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you, Keith. It's good to be here.
Before we start on even your background, tell the people, what is it, a master inventor?
A master inventor at IBM is someone that has contributed to IBM's patent portfolio. There's a lot of different master inventors amongst all of our various divisions at IBM, and we each invent different kinds of solutions, kinds of programs, or maybe software, hardware technology for the IBM company. And we take care at, you know, making sure we follow a process and we document the idea and file it with the USPTO.
And so then you get a patent.
Yes.
So the bottom line is that you will never be a master inventor if you don't have any patents.
Absolutely not. And
right.
I think, you know, it takes time to get there, but it's a doable thing. If I can do it, others can do it too.
Oh, that's humility. That's wonderful. Let's jump back, though. How did you begin to be a sort of a scientist, an engineer, somebody in this field as a young lady? What was, or a young girl in school? What were those dreams that you had, or what were those impetuses or impeti?
I know, when I was growing up, my mom was always very, adamant that both my sister and I, you know, do your very best. Haz lo mejor que puedas, they'd always tell us at home. And she'd say, go to school, do what you can to make sure you succeed and that you're doing well in school. So she always drilled that into us every day. You know, she'd drop us off from the car in the morning and she'd tell us all this. And so every day you go into school with the attitude of doing your very best, right? And I think when I was younger, growing up in the era that I did, I learned a lot about biology, math, science, but I never had computers at my fingertips. It wasn't until I graduated from high school out of Eagle Pass High School. So Eagle Pass is a small border town on the Rio Grande. And I kind of graduated and decided, well, maybe I want to go to college and pursue some kind of a degree. I started out as a biology major at the University of Texas in Austin. And then I quickly found out biology wasn't quite what I wanted to do, and I really loved math. To me, math was very black and white. You either got the answer or you didn't, and there was no in between, right? And so to me, you know, experimenting with math and taking all kinds of calculus and algorithms courses was, you know, a lot of fun. And then I started hearing about these things called computers, and they said, you know, maybe you ought to take a computer class. And so I took one of the first computer programming classes that I ever took in college, and I found that I really liked that. I was doing a lot of Pascal programming at that time, and it just, you know, it was something that intrigued me. And I thought, now, this is something fun that I like doing, that I can spend lots of time doing. And I think the other thing that I learned growing up watching my mom and my dad was you're going to spend 40 hours a week at a minimum working, so you better find something you're having fun at. And so I thought, maybe I could do this programming thing.
So that's interesting in the sense that you discovered this.
Yes.
When you're already quite a mature person.
Yes.
I mean, because it wasn't like we hear people that were looking at the stars since they were three or drumming around in the Rio Grande Valley when they were five and suddenly discovered something beautiful and they get a career.
Right.
But here you've got something where you studied in biology. What was the thing about biology that you really didn't like?
I didn't like getting bad grades. And so to me it was like, oh my gosh, I had to study really hard.
You had to have a reason for getting a bad grade.
I had to study really hard and it just wasn't paying off, whereas math just came easy to me. It was just, you know, problems were easy for me to solve. And I think part of it is you have the kind of mindset in you that says, okay, I can solve a problem, I can solve a puzzle, I can solve a program. And to me, that's why I lean more toward math, you know, toward computer science. And I really think computer science is kind of, you know, it was intriguing to me because I'd never even seen a computer. This was back in the day when we had punch cards at school and things of that nature.
Well, I remember those.
But it was a lot of fun, you know. I also found some nice friends that would work with me, help me out. You'd collaborate together, and that was a lot of fun to go through that. I almost was tempted to get into electrical engineering. I met a really cute guy that worked over in the engineering department, and he was really good looking and a very handsome young man. And I thought, well, maybe I should be an electrical engineer. And then I finally realized that's for him. This is for me. But I did wind up marrying that young man.
Oh, okay. Because I was going to say, he suggested that he come over to computer science, right?
He actually wound up getting his degree in electrical engineering and then took his first job as a programmer. Yeah.
Okay.
So I think, you know, one of the things that I also was open to was, you know, getting my degree and maybe exploring different things as I got out into the real world. I think, you know, some people do grow up, like you said, knowing what they want to be, you know, when they're very young. Others of us, you know, we kind of evolve into it. And, you know, one of the nice things I found at working at IBM is it's such a large company. I've had about, you know, six different jobs. So about every 5 years, I can change the role I play, the approach I take at doing my work. I run different programs at IBM. And it's just kind of a neat environment because you can evolve your career that way.
How did you meet the real world? I mean, okay, so there you are, a young lady from Eagle Pass, Texas, on the Rio Grande in southern part of Texas. And then you go to UT Austin. What was the transition like? I mean, how did you then find the real world?
Yeah, I think for me, my parents were pretty poor, and they said, you know, at some point in time, you got to figure out how you're going to support yourself, how you're going to finish getting yourself through school. And the other alternative I had was to go back to Eagle Pass and, you know, maybe spend a semester or two there working and trying to raise money. And I kind of opted to stay at UT, and I found a nice part-time job at IBM. So I was even working for IBM while I was a college student, and wound up taking a lot of hours, a lot of courses at school while I was doing some work. Wasn't easy, but it's a doable thing.
How long did it take you to get your degree?
I actually set some records. I got my degree in about 3.5 years.
3.5 years,
three
and,
half
working
years.
Half-time out there.
Yes, I had no fun
impressive.
In college.
Well, you found a husband.
But I found my husband, yes, indeed. And it was just a lot of different approaches to things. I think when you know you're under the gun to pay financially for your schooling and things like that, and you know, geez, I'm not qualifying for additional mm-hmm. loans, additional scholarships, and you just kind of work your way through it, you got to figure it out, right?
I'm going to make sure my sons listen to the program.
I was very lucky. There was a family that had lived in Eagle Pass, the Aguileras is their last name, and they lived in Austin. And I would say, you know, what I found very nice was finding people like that, people that will help you along your way. They actually, you know, had me living with them for a while, which is a phenomenal, you know, support system that you have. So I would live with them. I'd go to work. I'd go to school. And, you know, people help you along the way. And I think everyone needs a little bit of help now and then. And you got to figure out who are the right people to help you out and how do you move forward.
Let's talk a little bit about IBM and what they do and what you do for them. I mean, there's a word that is on everybody's lips these days. It's smart. Everything has got to be smart. The phone has got to be a smartphone. The city, the bus service. I mean, what is there that's not smart? And then you think, well, what does smart really mean? You know, I mean, and then it means different things. And clearly it means intelligent. It means the ability to get things done. But it's also used in a sense, if you wouldn't mind me saying so, as something to do with the superficiality of life. Oh, that looks a smart outfit. So this is an appearances. All right. And then there's other things like, I don't know, smart aleck, all right, or smarty pants. So it's a very complicated term. And I'm not quite sure that I understand that a smartphone is a tremendous advance over some other communication technologies. So let's start with your sort of explanation, if you wouldn't mind, of what IBM's concept of smart is.
Okay. So IBM, one of its major themes is Smarter Planet. And part of what we're after at IBM is, you know, we're looking at the explosion of data, right? You mentioned yourself, there's cell phone technology, there's a lot of devices and sensors that we make available. And part of what we're looking at is saying, how do you harness all of this data and make good sense out of it? So how do you integrate it, analyze it, and produce something that is of value to society? So having a Smarter Planet themes, we think of, you know, being in instrument it. So having those smartphones, devices, things like that, being interconnected, connecting those cell phones and all those devices to all kinds of data, and then being intelligent, helping you make intelligent decisions and sort through and visualize that data in an effective manner. I think we're all bombarded with, you know, data at our fingertips. And part of what we're looking for now is how can someone help us make sense of that data, as opposed to me having to read through the massive amounts of information that can be presented to me on the internet or presented to me, you know, in access to email. How can someone take that information, boil it down for me, and make it easy for me to make sense out of all of that? And so having the instrumentation, the integration, and the intelligence is really important. I think, you know,
it's a seamless flow of information.
Yes.
That comes to you with the particular crucial part that perhaps facilitates your day or right. your particular function,
right.
and the rest of it gets filtered out.
Right. And I think, you know, part of what IBM does is we do a lot of services with clients, and we use these Smarter Planet themes to say, how do you apply the aspects of being intelligent, interconnected, and having these devices all connected together to improve the business you're in, to improve the world that we live in. And, you know, that can be a scary thing. You know, some of us think, wow, you know, all this information's out there. Is it going to take over the world? Is it, you know, coming up on the HAL computers of the future? And part of it is you have to be open to things and you have to use technology in the right fashion. I mean, how many of us were afraid to use the internet, right, and put our credit card numbers out on the internet? And nowadays, a lot of us don't bat an eye. I know our younger generation certainly loves social networking tools, loves doing all kinds of fun things on technology. And I think, you know, as we continue to evolve, you got to figure out the value in using technology to provide benefit to our society. And that's really what IBM Smarter Planet is all about.
And you're a master inventor. Tell the audience in relatively simple terms, if you don't mind, what it is that one of your major contributions, your major inventions that has facilitated this smart world of ours.
Yeah, so I do a lot of work with a lot of different clients. When you think about Smarter Planet and then you boil it down into a smarter city, I've done a lot of projects with various different cities throughout the world. One of the projects that I focused on for a long time was an emission dashboard, right? Think of, you know, a city that monitors chemicals being produced by a particular energy and utility plant and being able to monitor how much chemicals are putting into the air by, you know, the coal that they're mining through and how they're burning up the coal and getting all of that emission under control is something that, you know, certainly we all strive to do, right? There's even up in Canada regulations for how much chemical you can emit into the air. So we were working with a large company there to help them monitor all those chemicals, make sure they don't go overboard on how much, you know, pollution they're putting out into the air. And so that's part of making a smarter city, having that level of sophistication to monitor chemical emissions.
So, I mean, if I was to, since I'm a chemist, I know how to know if there are chemicals in the environment, but that takes spectroscopic analysis and, you know, it's not just a computer-based sort of operation. So then what you did, presumably, the company or the organization set up their spectroscopic monitors and then get all this data real time, and then you've showed them way how to sort of put it together and show it as little graphical displays.
So we took all of their data.
Like having a decibel meter. But,
absolutely. You know. We took all of their data, we analyzed it, and we consolidated it, integrated it, and then we presented it in a nice browser interface, or, you know, Internet Explorer or Firefox environment where you could easily go through and see how much chemical was being emitted into the air. So that was a pretty cool invention. Making those little dials move smoothly with, you know, sub-second response time was a big challenge for our team, but we accomplished that, and it was a really, you know, cool deliverable we had with the client. We went and we deployed all of our software and our invention into the client's environment to help us enable all of that.
We'll come back to that in a minute, but just have to take a break. You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here with master inventor and distinguished engineer Romelia Flores from IBM. We'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. David Neisel.
And I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog. You may not realize that for years, scientists considered the vast majority of our DNA, about 98%, as junk DNA, since these sequences don't encode proteins and were assumed to be doing nothing.
But the idea is being challenged by hundreds of researchers from a revolutionary international project called ENCODE, which stands for the Encyclopedia of DNA Elements. Their studies over the past 5 years suggest that more than 80% of the human genome is used for something important in keeping us healthy.
This group of non-coding DNA elements may enhance, promote, and regulate the massive, precise interworkings of cellular functions. They can determine whether our proteins end up working properly, which is crucial in cells.
Studies are now pointing to genetic diseases that originate near or within these non-coding DNA sequences. For example, a rare brain disorder called Ravine encephalopathy causes severe anorexia in infants. It's due to a defect in a non-coding DNA sequence that leaves neurons unstable and degenerates the brain's white matter.
But beyond helping us understand disease, the significance of ENCODE's results is that it takes us a step beyond the Human Genome Project, which first laid out the genes. Now, after studying 150 different types of cells, ENCODE defines and explains the roles of our genes.
They reveal the marvelous complexity of the human genome that can signal almost 20,000 genes at the exact time and location to allow a fetus to develop normally. The ENCODE project provides a rich source for many more years of research.
We are Drs. David Niesel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more on this and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Romelia Flores, master inventor and distinguished engineer from IBM. This concept of smart, I mean, I tried at the beginning to throw out that there are other interpretations of the word smart. It's a superficial concept of this is smart. What do you see as someone that's sort of intimately associated and a career pushing the world to be your vision of smart? What are the drawbacks to this? Where let me just preface that by saying that I just recently got an email from somebody. It was a quotation from Einstein. And basically the quotation was, his greatest fear for mankind was that the tools and the technology that we use would be far more intelligent than the people using it. And then it showed photographs of kids, young people anyway, texting and not talking, and all sorts of environments, at dinner, at a football game, at a basketball game, I mean, all the social things where you think there might be some excitement going on that would take the personalities involved, talking or hands up in the air screaming, and they're all texting. I think that's ridiculous. Yeah. But, you know, I'm 70.
Well, and certainly there are differences in the generations. I think from my point of view, we all have to use technology at the right time, at the right place, right? And I think, you know, if you look at technology and having, you know, computers that are more intelligent than us, I think that's fantastic, right? I mean, what I'm looking for is computers to solve major issues in the world, you know, cancer research, being able to do DNA sequencing more efficiently than a human being can. And I think part of what you have to do is figure out, how do I make sure the computers are set up in a fashion that's of value to our doctors, our physicians, our, you know, people in society that can gain value from all of that. I think there generally is a fear on, you know, our younger generation. I look at my own son, who's 12 years old, and I know he loves being on his PSP and doing all his video games. And part of what, you know, as a parent you have to do is kind of limit some of that. And you have to say, okay, it's time to be off of those, you know, computer systems and go out and play basketball, go out and get some fresh air, and, you know, and right. Force your kids to do that. I believe.
In my household, the only way to get them off of the god-awful games is to say, I now want to watch a soccer game from Europe.
Yes.
And then I take over the television.
Yes, and you've
but then
got
that's
to
counterproductive,
that.
too.
Yes. And I know it's hard for our young kids. I think as a society, they're growing up with a whole lot of technology at their fingertips. I look at what my son, who's a 12-year-old, knows today about technical devices and how to integrate them, you know, with his remote device into the TV set and doing things like that. I think that's phenomenal, and it's of huge value. I think everything within reason and within balance is appropriate, right? And you just got to figure out what is within reason and what is within balance, right?
Well, in IBM, for example, I read an article or I heard an article about some CEO of some company that tried as an experiment to sort of stop using email for a week. And he said it was very difficult, but he managed to do it. And then when he came back, you know, he obviously had this collection of emails that he had to go through. but he started to send down through the company, you know, less email. And I know in my own small world of being a professor of chemistry, the number of emails that I get, which are, I don't need them. It will all be settled. You know, a 30-minute collection of emails backwards and forwards to sort of do something that would take half a minute on the telephone. Yeah. Does IBM have any policy about making people sometimes talk?
Yes, it is good to make people talk. I think there are no real IBM policies in this area, but we are experimenting with new techniques and new ways of being. I know some of our social media evangelists, you know, are looking at, how do I have a world without email? And I've seen wonderful presentations that they're, you know, evolving within the IBM company to help us all get there. I think also some of our tools that we have like instant messaging type of tools to help us effectively reach out to our colleagues around the world and be able to tap into them very quickly without having to send an email. We have other kinds of technology that enables us to effectively collaborate and share presentation materials and things like that. And one of the projects that I've undertaken over the last year and a half with one of my colleagues, Mr. Leonard Hand, is to, you know, figure out how do you know a valid source of information. And we're creating, you know, what we call an asset factory to help us reuse presentation material, documents, and use them effectively with a voice of authority behind them. So things get placed into this factory that have been governed, that we know are valid, you know, pieces of information. And then you as a user can feel confident that, yay, verily, that is validated information. I go and I use it, and it's the latest and greatest. It's kept up to date for me, as opposed to having to hunt around, you know, hundreds right. of different presentations, hundreds of different charts and slideware. You know, this is the source of truth. And so we're focused on that. And I think what I see it as at IBM is a lot of different people pushing in different directions to help find the answers to that. I would say there is no silver bullet right now, but as long as we're all looking for that silver bullet, I think that's part of the key.
I mean, it's all interesting, and I'm just remembering in my head what IBM was, because when I came to America, IBM was a big deal, Big Blue and all the rest of this. And they had a reputation for being pretty buttoned down. I don't know if that's the expression.
Yes.
Not that I ever saw any of these. It's just what I read in the paper and hear from conversation. You know, and then they're sort of like when you see two Mormon missionaries going around in the area, you know, you immediately know, hey, these guys are Mormon missionaries because they're well-dressed and too smart almost for the environment. Mm-hmm. Did IBM have a problem with trying to change its image at some stage? I gather there was a transition
where
you were too buttoned down and now you've changed.
Yeah, I'd say, you know, having been with IBM 30 years, I've seen huge differences in the IBM of old to where we are today. Certainly in the 80s, we went through some major evolution. Lou Gerstner took on the IBM company and made major transformation for the IBM company. I think certainly we've evolved under Sam Palmisano and now under Ginni Rometty. I think each one of our CEOs has a different style to them. If you look at, you know, our current CEO, Ginni Rometty, she's very client-focused and tells us to, you know, be like our clients, to work with our clients, to collaborate with our clients, and bring the best of IBM to the client, right? Because IBM has over 500,000 employees worldwide. There's no way that I can know everything about IBM, but what I can do effectively is know who my colleagues are. I know who all the other distinguished engineers right. within the IBM company are, and I think the intent is maybe that I don't have to solve each and every one of my clients' problems, but that I bring to bear the best of research, the best of hardware, software, services teams in front of our clients to help them effectively solve their issues and major challenges that they may need addressing.
But you'd have to go through some training for this. I mean, you know, you started out as the technical person with computer science, mathematics, but what you're coming down to is the fact that in the end, we still have to communicate with people, whether in you it's your customer, me it's my students, obviously family, but you know, the communication skills.
And absolutely.
They are being lost, as far as I'm, Keith Pannell, concerned.
Yeah.
All right? And they're being lost because of all these other methodologies for communicating that have nothing to do with personality.
Right, right. I think you're on target there. I mean, certainly what I see, having worked with a lot of, you know, different folks in my whole career is a loss for communication, not just verbal skills, but also written skills.
No.
Being able to, you know, write a patent requires some writing. Being able to publish a book requires
writing.
That's
an imagination, I would tell you.
to convey ideas requires a lot of writing. And,
right.
and you can't rely on others to do the writing for you, and you have to be able to communicate effectively.
Does IBM have, or big companies in general, do they have special training courses to sort of bring people up to speed? Because I must say, most of the students that I see, you know, when they graduate with technical degrees, they're pretty poor at writing.
Yeah. IBM has a lot of different programs. I'd say one of the fun undertakings that I've had the pleasure of leading over the last year and a half is I get new hires into the IBM company assigned to the team that I work in Dallas, and I get to work with these young individuals that are brand new IBMers straight out of college. They have degrees in maybe electrical engineering, mechanical engineering, computer science, or business degrees.
But you don't have people come from, say, English. I mean, liberal arts people can make a contribution to technological companies.
Absolutely.
I would think.
We've had musicians, we've had English people, we've had all kinds coming into the program, and we put them through a lot of training. And the training consists of, you know, how do you go and have conversations with a client? How do you do some deep technical work? How do you present in front of a client? How do you write, you know, documentation in support of some of the technical work you're doing? So we try and have a broad range of things that we cover, some that will resonate with some of the kids, some of the, you know, other topics resonate with others.
So, I mean, there's a whole
balances
program
out.
There.
Oh, absolutely. Right. It's about a year-long immersion that these young folks go through to get
they ever get to do anything.
Before they ever go out and
sounds
land
like going
in their
to Los Alamos. I mean, training with nuclear materials.
Yes.
Let's change the topic. We've got a few minutes left. And, you know, clearly you're a special person within, you know, IBM in the sense you're a master inventor, you're the distinguished engineer, and yet you're a Hispanic female. There aren't enough of those sort of role models out there, I think. You have a family, you alluded to. Does IBM or does American business have a special pathway that permits you to be both creative in terms of your inventions and your engineering and being a mother? Because it seems to me that we're wasting an awful lot of brilliant minds because there's not enough facility for ladies to progress.
Yeah. I think part of the secret to my success, at least, was I had a wonderful mother, right? She taught me right from wrong when I was little. But probably more importantly, she helped me out a lot, you know, in helping raise my kids. So I do have, you know, two young kids. One's 20 years old, one's 10 years old. So I have a decade difference between my two kids. But part of what I think I did depend on was my mother and father always being there. When I was off traveling and doing work assignments, my mother and father would come up and help with my young, you know, daughter as she was kind of growing up and help my husband, you know, take care of that.
What about the company? Is American business beginning to recognize that there's a lot of talent out
Absolutely.
There that needs?
There's a lot of programs that are out there. I know when I had each one of my kids, I'd take about, you know, my normal maternity leave, and then I'd take additional time off to focus on my family, to focus on the priority at hand, you know, while my kids were, you know, between, you know, 1 month to 1 year of age, I wanted to focus on them. And that was a choice I deliberately made. And I took advantage of some of the programs that companies like IBM and other companies, I'm sure, have similar kinds of programs where you can take a leave of absence and then, you know, figure things out when you're ready to come back to work.
You've been listening to Science Studio. We've had today with us Romelia Flores from IBM, distinguished engineer, master inventor, and one of the creators of this so-called smart world that we're going to be facing. If it's anything to do with it, people like Romelia, we're in good hands. Norma Martinez, I'd like to thank you again for putting the program together. I'd like to thank the listener for being there, and we'll be back next week with another riveting Science Studio.
I'm Noemi Rojas with your Synapse Flash. Medical students, physicians, and faculty from the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine will have a free health fair at Texas Tech's Family Medicine Clinic on Kenworthy Street. Bicycle helmets will be given away to the first 100 children ages 4 through 6. The fair takes place 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. on Saturday, March 9th. Read more at Synapse, the region's life sciences news digest. Go to mcasynapse.org.